You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Since the Syrian conflict began in 2011, more than 100,000 Syrians have been killed and more than 2.3 million refugees, half of them children, have fled the country, many into neighboring Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Meanwhile, the rest of the world has been reluctant to fully intervene, and peace talks have been delayed. In the United States, experts as well as policymakers of all political stripes have been divided on how much the United States should get involved. Nada Hashemi and Danny Postel have edited a book called The Syria Dilemma, a collection of essays by Middle East scholars, journalists, and experts that explores the various political and ethical concerns over intervention. It's published by the MIT Press and brings to our show Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies and an associate professor of Middle East and Islamic Politics at the University of Denver's Joseph Korbel School for International Studies. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Last January, which is a year ago, pretty much, you hosted a conference on the Syrian crisis. Did that conference lead you to think about putting together this collection of essays?
Absolutely. The bulk of the essays in the book really are based on that conference that we organized in Denver last January, sort of recognizing that Syria and the conflict in Syria was an important topic, and there was very sort of little good literature, or at least in this case, a book that sort of put together perspectives that addressed the critical question that's on the minds of many people: what should be done about Syria? So that's really the background to the book, and that's what the focus of the book really is about. It's about bringing together people who have important things to say about the crisis and what the international community could be doing or should be doing to bring that conflict to an end.
Well, many of these contributors disagree on how the United States and the rest of the world should respond to the war in Syria. What do the various points of view tell us about this crisis?
Well, I mean, there's no consensus on what should be done, and I think that just highlights the complexity that Syria sort of poses for the international community, and that's why the conflict has dragged on for so long, because there is no consensus or unanimity among the key players, both in Syria, in the region, and in the international community on what should be done. So I think, the fact that there are divergent perspectives and that there is no easy answers just highlights how challenging Syria, the question of Syria is today for the world.
Well, outside of the Middle East, which countries have the greatest interest in Syria?
Well, outside of the Middle East, I mean, the UN Security Council is sort of divided. Largely, it's Russia primarily, who's one of Assad's biggest backers, China to a lesser degree on one side.
And why are they so invested in Syria?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, my own view is that Russia's support for the Assad regime really has little to do with any particular affinity for the regime in Damascus itself. I think it really has to do with global politics and geopolitics. And Russia, I think, is using the conflict in Syria as a test case to send a message to the West, to the United States in particular, that the United States and its allies cannot unilaterally sort of write the rules of international global politics in terms of which regimes can stand, which regimes can be toppled. This really goes back to the debate in Libya a couple of years ago, when the UN Security Council passed a sort of resolution that the Russians reluctantly signed on to, but were very upset in terms of what was done with that resolution in terms of toppling the Gaddafi regime. And they're, I think, drawing a firm line in the sand with respect to Syria and sending a message, trying to send a message that, Russia is not going to sort of stand by and allow the United States to assert its will on the international stage. And so that's really what I think, what motivates Russia the most. There's a lot of talk about, Russia's sort of arms supplies to the Damascus regime, the port in Latakia, the Russian port. I don't think those are sort of primary motives. I think it has to do with bigger sort of issues rooted in the functioning of and the rules of international relations.
And has Russia's position had an impact on Western involvement, possible Western involvement?
Yeah, because, there's not a lot of incentive and interest on the other side, particularly in the United States, to sort of challenge the Russian position. The conflict in Syria is viewed by both politicians, our foreign policy establishment, and by broad members of the American public, the conflict in Syria is viewed through the prism of Iraq and the consequences that that has had for the United States, for our economy. And so there's no, I think, attempt to really challenge Russia on its own position on Syria. I'm of the view that if the United States were to take a position, a serious position, to try and, you know, bring this conflict to a resolution, Russia would back down. I don't think they're going to go to war over this. But the absence of any sort of serious foreign policy thinking and assertiveness by the Obama administration has basically allowed Russia to dominate and set the agenda for the conflict in Syria. And we saw that very clearly a few months ago with respect to the chemical weapons agreement, where the Russians basically inserted themselves in the middle of the Syrian conflict and proposed this agreement that called for the removal of chemical weapons from Syria, preventing an American airstrike on the Assad regime and effectively strengthening the Assad regime as a consequence. And we're seeing the consequences of that right now playing themselves out on the ground in Syria today.
Are we aware of major divisions within the Obama administration?
Yeah, there's been a lot of good reporting, you know, on this in the New York Times. Dexter Filkins wrote a detailed piece about this, I believe, in the New Yorker, where there have been, you know, major, you know, divisions. One of Obama's closest foreign policy advisors now are UN Ambassador Samantha Power and Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton were strongly in favor of, you know, taking a more assertive stand, supporting and arming the moderate Democratic opposition in Syria. And then there's the anti-interventionists who believe that, look, it's just too risky of an endeavor. I think Obama himself, you know, has leaned in the position of not getting involved. He's stated several times that, look, I was elected to end wars, not to start them, particularly in the Middle East. He's been trying to pivot to Asia. And so when, you know, the internal debates were taking place in the White House, Obama leaned heavily in the direction of those advisors who were saying, look, stay out, it's too risky, it'll suck us in, it'll be bad for your presidency. And I think that has been the position that he's sticking to, and there's sort of a sense in the White House that they're just hoping that this conflict will go away, will sort of be contained within the conflict in Syria, notwithstanding the humanitarian tragedy and the human rights catastrophe that is unfolding before our eyes. But I think that's the position the Obama administration has taken up until today. I think it's a short-term position, and I think, you know, the United States eventually is going to get dragged into this, but that remains to be seen.
Well, in Congress, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and some others, mostly Republicans, have been outspoken advocates for intervention. Is the division in Washington largely along party lines?
No, I mean, there's a lot of interesting sort of alliances from people from different ideological perspectives. I mean, the Republican Party Congress people that you just mentioned, I think, are actually minority voices within the Republican Party. You have, I think, a much more louder and arguably more popular Republican current position articulated by Rand Paul, which, you know, goes back to the deep sort of isolationist strand in U.S. foreign policy that has existed in this country, that has sort of, you know, argued that, look, Syria doesn't affect our immediate national vital interests. We should not get involved. This is sort of a conflict that doesn't really concern us. And that's a view that I think has large resonance and support in the mind of many Americans, largely as a result of the catastrophes in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there's a lot of strange bedfellows here. Ironically, there's, you know, a common sort of set of positions that you can see within the Republican Party and maybe many people in the peace community and on the, you know, political left in this country who don't want to get involved in Syria for different reasons, but they, you know, coalesce around sort of a strong non-interventionist position.
Aren't part of a number of the problems that the United States really doesn't see the Syrian conflict as being a threat to its own security, and that the opposition is no longer dominated by the moderate, more democratic group, but has attracted al-Qaeda fighters from all over the world, and they are now the major rebel force?
Yeah, I mean, these things are linked, intimately linked. I mean, the irony here, you know, when we say that, you know, Syria doesn't affect our security, what we're seeing right now is a direct result of the absence of strong international support, particularly U.S. support, for the moderate Syrian opposition. We're seeing large sections of Syria now being turned over to al-Qaeda into rebel groups. We're seeing Syria becoming another Afghanistan, where it's a haven for attracting a lot of disgruntled, unemployed youth within the Arab world who are flocking to Syria. And, of course, the concern is when they return to their own countries, they could destabilize those countries, as we saw in Afghanistan. So I think, you know, the foreign policy position of non-intervention, of sort of turning away from Syria, is now having very negative consequences. Right at the beginning, you know, when debates were taking place, there was a sense that, look, the rebel opposition was too fragmented. There was no guarantee that if we supported the good guys, the weapons would stay in the hands of the good guys. And now, you know, the situation has spun out of control where, you know, the worst fears that the administration has had has actually come to fruition now. And now we're seeing, you know, unintended consequences that, in my view, in my reading of what's happening in terms of where things are headed, are going to sort of destabilize not only the entire Middle East, because many countries are affected by what's happening, but also vital U.S. national security interests, precisely because of the spread and the rise of al-Qaeda-affiliated groups who are now, you know, dominating the battlefield in Syria.
My guest is Nada Hashemi, who's director of the Center for Middle East Studies and an associate professor of Middle East and Islamic Politics at the University of Denver's Joseph Korbel School of International Studies. He and Danny Postel have co-edited a book called The Syria Dilemma. Why has Saudi Arabia been so critical of the U.S. approach?
Well, I think the Saudi Arabia's sort of interest in Syria has nothing to do with, you know, democracy or human rights. It really has to do with its geostrategic rivalry in the region with Iran. The Saudis have been deeply upset with the balance of power in the Middle East that has, in their reading, tilted in favor of Iran post-2003 with the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the rise to power of Shi'i political parties allied and supportive or sympathetic to Iran. The Saudis are hoping to sort of redress the balance by toppling an Iranian ally in Damascus. They're hoping that if Assad can be toppled, that their power and prestige and influence and consequently, Iran's influence will be diminished. So I think, you know, the Saudis are really interested in really, you know, that particular aspect of the conflict in Syria, diminishing Iranian influence, trying to expand their influence in Syria by toppling a pro-Iranian ally and hoping that in the aftermath, a Sunni sort of political entity, sympathetic or allied to Saudi Arabia, will replace the Assad regime.
In one of the essays in your book, Fareed Zakaria argues that Iraq is a reference point for why the United States should not get involved in Syria. He says that Syria should be left to work this out on its own. What is the gist of his argument?
Well, the gist of his argument is that, you know, Syria is another Iraq, in the same way that the United States could not steer Iraq in a positive direction despite the presence of hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops and allied troops there, that if we try and get involved in Syria, we're going to get sucked in and it's going to be a replay of what we saw in Iraq. So his perspective sort of is one that is deeply pessimistic about any sort of opportunities for external powers to change the course of the Syrian war and to push it in a positive direction. And it's a perspective that, you know, I think has, again, a lot of sympathy and support among the broader American public because of the legacy of Iraq that we're still dealing with. But the problem that we're seeing right now is the absence of any, I think, serious American leadership in trying to steer the conflict in Syria in a positive direction is also having consequences. In other words, there are huge consequences for non-intervention, and we're seeing them playing themselves right now, not only the spread of al-Qaeda and the radicalization of large parts of Syria and the Middle East, but, you know, refugee flows that are, you know, in you know, the figure is that 40% of Syrians now are either internally displaced or turned into refugees, the gradual destabilization of neighboring countries. So there are huge consequences on the other side of the equation to what Fareed Zakaria and others have been arguing. Non-intervention, in other words, does have a cost to bear, and we're seeing that cost playing themselves out before our eyes.
Are there any policymakers who are sharing his point of view?
I think the vast majority of them are, because, you know, Iraq has been the primary reference point that most Americans and policymakers have with respect to the conflict in Syria. That's a neighboring country. That's a conflict that, you know, has sucked a lot of our resources here in the United States, cost us an incredible amount of money. And so people, you know, immediately recoil when there's any thought of another form of intervention in Syria. But, of course, you know, the difference is that no one seriously is calling for American troops to be placed in Syria. Those people who are advocating intervention, including, you know, people like Senators McCain and Graham and others, are really calling for American leadership, at most a no-fly zone, better arming of the Syrian moderate democratic opposition to change the course of the war and at least provide a better set of conditions that could lead to a negotiated settlement.
They want something similar to what happened with Libya, but Libya has turned out to be a total mess post-Gaddafi, so nobody ever thought, well, once we topple Gaddafi, we're going to still have a lot of problems. And I assume there should be concerns about something similarly happening in Syria.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the solution to Syria cannot simply be, you know, a military sort of engagement by the international community led by the United States. Syria's future and any solution to the Syrian conflict has to be, I think, a multifaceted and a much more robust sort of plan of action that includes military intervention to support the moderate democratic opposition and tip the balance of power. But there also has to be a plan for a post-conflict sort of stabilization process, plan for economic reconstruction, a political plan that sort of guarantees minority rights, some form of, you know, UN peacekeeping to protect minority groups. It has to be a comprehensive plan. What I've argued before in some of my writings and lectures on this topic is that the model that I sort of see here is what worked in the Balkans, in Bosnia, and in Kosovo 20 years ago, when the Clinton administration, similar to the Obama administration, was really standing on the sidelines as we saw this, you know, catastrophe, moral and political and humanitarian catastrophe unfold before our eyes. And then there was this, you know, dramatic event in Srebrenica that killed between 7,000 and 8,000 people. There was fears that the entire southeastern Europe were being destabilized. And then the Clinton administration basically shifted policy, appointed Ambassador Holbrooke to sort of lead an international effort that brought that conflict to an end, but brought it to an end in a comprehensive way. It wasn't simply just sort of, you know, dropping bombs and intervening militarily. There was a plan for a political plan to sort of reconstitute the future of Bosnia, a plan for stabilization, economic reconstruction. Now, Bosnia is, you know, far from a perfect place, but it's much better than it was, you know, prior to, you know, the U.S. leadership and the intervention that did take place that fundamentally brought that conflict to an end. And my own sense is that, you know, if this conflict is to be resolved in a serious way that can stabilize not only Syria but the Middle East, you would need something of that magnitude. But, of course, for that to happen, it would require a major change in policy and investment in resources and time, and, yes, risk as well. There's no guarantee that it'll work, but the Obama administration would have to sort of, you know, make a decision that they're going to try and, you know, steer this conflict in a positive direction.
Well, how could you guarantee that post-Assad, the new government would be to our liking? We have seen a disaster in Iraq, in Afghanistan, as I said, in Libya, Egypt. Mubarak was felled, and look at the mess that's there. You can't just go in there and then tell them how to organize their government, can you?
No, you can't. You can't, and you shouldn't. A lot of the reasons why we've seen these types of destabilization and chaos in many of the countries that you just mentioned have little to do with, you know, U.S. intervention. It largely has to do with the legacy of the really failed post-colonial states and the authoritarianism that has dominated the landscape and the, you know, the consequences that, you know, decades of dictatorship has sort of wreaked on these societies. That's something that, I mean, the United States, I think, is responsible to the extent that we have been supporting dictators who have been presiding over those societies, such as, you know, Mubarak in Egypt. But I don't think we can really sort of, the United States is not to be blamed for the chaos in Libya or in Iraq, because those post-colonial regimes were not backed by the United States. So there's no guarantee that this is going to sort of have an easy solution. In fact, I'm of the view that, you know, the assumption that if, you know, we intervene and we support, you know, rebel groups or groups that are committed to democracy, that, you know, any of these countries are going to be stable and democratic within the next 5 to 10 years. I think we have to be looking at these questions and the prospects for stability and democratization from a much longer-term perspective, largely because these societies have been really brutalized by the legacy of political authoritarianism and dictatorship that has dominated the region since World War II. So there's no, you know, quick fixes here. But I think one has to make sort of calculations that not getting involved, keeping Gaddafi in power, I think would have been much worse for the people of Libya. Yes, Libya is chaotic today, but, you know, I didn't have any expectations that Libya would turn into Sweden after the toppling of Gaddafi. It's going to take time. It's going to take, you know, an investment in Libya supporting the more moderate democratic forces, and there's going to be huge challenges along the way. So I think, you know, anyone who's thinking there's going to be quick fixes here in Libya or Egypt or in Iraq today is going to be mistaken.
Nada Hashemi of the University of Denver, co-editor with Danny Postel of a book called The Syria Dilemma, which features essays by a number of recognizable experts in policy making, pundits as well. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Nada Hashemi, director of the Center for Middle East Studies and an associate professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the University of Denver's Joseph Corbell School of International Studies. He is co-editor with Danny Postel of a series of essays published by MIT Press called The Syria Dilemma. Beyond wanting to prevent bloodshed and protect the lives of many innocent people, what's the most compelling argument for U.S. intervention? To secure chemical weapons? To forge ties with potential successors of the Assad regime? To end the killing? Because Anne-Marie Slaughter writes, it is time to stand neither for the Syrian opposition nor against the Syrian government, but against killing by either side.
Well, I think the humanitarian sort of argument is the most important one. You know, Syria today represents the largest humanitarian and moral catastrophe of the 21st century. You know, arguably, Darfur was worse. But if you just look at the figures, over 100,000 people killed, you know, far surpassing the killing fields in Bosnia. 40% of the population turned into refugees or internally displaced. Just this week, the United Nations launched this special appeal calling for $6.5 billion in aid, humanitarian aid for Syria, because they're predicting that 75% of Syria's population will be in need of food support.
There was an NPR report this morning that pointed out that children have become targets of mostly of the government. Why are they going after children?
I think just to terrorize the opposition and to sort of silence the protests. I mean, we have to remember here that the Assad regime is, you know, one of the worst human rights violators in the Middle East. If you were to sort of place the Assad regime and situate it on a spectrum of repression, it would be situated and should be situated at the extreme end of a spectrum of repression. Arguably, Iraq under Saddam Hussein was worse, but this is a regime with a brutal human rights record, and so it was completely predictable that they would go after children, use chemical weapons, engage in sort of systematic rape, target the civilian population in the way that they have, commit what the UN has, you know, repeatedly described as state-sanctioned war crimes and crimes against humanity. So I think, you know, getting back to your question, that's the most compelling sort of argument. Of course, that's a moral argument, and our foreign policy is not made simply on moral sort of for moral reasons. But I mean, in terms of the broader sort of reading public, we're thinking about this question. If you just look at the data, you look at the human rights reports. I mean, just today, the UN Special Commissioner of Inquiry released another report, you know, titled "Without a Trace: Enforced Disappearances in Syria," just chronicling the, you know, systematic detention and torture of opposition activists and people who are opposing the Assad regime, putting them in detention camps. I mean, no one knows what the exact number are, but, you know, they're not faring very well there. Those are sort of, you know, brutal detention centers where systematic torture is taking place on a massive level. So, I mean, if you look at Syria from that perspective, this is one of the great, you know, moral and, you know, humanitarian, human rights catastrophes of the 21st century.
On the other hand, there are religious concerns. There are many religious and ethnic groups in Syria, the Sunnis, the Shias, the Christians, and the Alawites. The Assad regime would argue that it has been able to balance the demands of the majority with the various minorities since they came to power. It looks like if they are toppled, there's going to be a Sunni majority, and the other groups fear that they're going to wind up being targeted.
Yeah, those are very legitimate fears. That's why any, I think, solution to Syria has to include sort of ironclad guarantees that minorities will be protected, and we need to be, I think, the international community should be supporting precisely those forces that have a, you know, open and, serious commitment to protecting minority rights. But, of course, you know, the situation of, you know, minorities within a dictatorship, those minority rights, I think, can only fundamentally be guaranteed over the long term.
But we've seen a problem in Iraq in this regard.
Absolutely. I mean, when the state sort of destabilizes and you have sort of complete chaos, then unfortunately, minorities are often the first target. But looking long term, I think minorities can only be protected in the context of a strong democratic constitutional framework where there is not only legal protection but also, you know, enforcement mechanisms to protect their rights. And that, of course, you know, requires a transition to democracy, which will take time. And in that process, you know, minorities are vulnerable. So I mean, it's a very important question, but I don't think one can sort of make a convincing argument that minorities, you know, over the long term will be protected, are better protected by living under the rule of a fascist regime that, you know, is simply, protecting, you know, their rights. It's protecting them, yes, but it's not a long-term sort of solution. And, of course, at the end of the day, and this often gets forgotten when this topic is brought up, minorities in the Middle East, in Syria, in Iraq, in Egypt today, for example, can never sort of have full protection and security when the vast majority of the population, the dominant majority groups, are living in insecurity, when they don't have basic legal rights, political rights, and will constantly be agitating for political change. So I think one has to view this question of minority rights within a larger framework, within a framework of democratic transitions, the existence of a functioning legal system that will protect everyone, not only minorities, but the majority as well.
Isn't one of the problems that the more democratic rebel group, the one that the United States and its allies support, has refused to enter into any peace negotiations?
Well, that's the argument that you're hearing, but of course they have agreed to go to the talks in Switzerland next month. They're reluctant to do so because, understandably, from their perspective, it's very difficult for people in the opposition to sit across the table from a regime that has perpetrated, you know, state-sanctioned war crimes and crimes against humanity and has a lot of blood on their hands. So there's a lot of domestic resistance from supporters of the Syrian revolution for, you know, going to a peace conference and shaking hands with the other side that has a lot of blood on their hands. I think most people can sympathize with the reluctance of the opposition to go to Geneva. But I think this, you know, Geneva, Switzerland sort of conference is not going to lead anywhere, largely because Assad now is much stronger today than he was last year. He's benefited from this chemical weapons agreement. The opposition is weaker. The moderate opposition effectively is in disarray, particularly on the battlefield, and more extremist elements are on the rise. So, and Assad has been very open in stating that, you know, they have no, I mean, in fact, you know, Assad's information minister just last week openly stated, and I'm quoting him, that if anyone thinks that we are going to Geneva to hand over the keys of Damascus to the opposition, they can just not show up. And then he added that a transition in Syria will be led by President Assad if there will be a transition at all. So they have no incentive to bargain or negotiate when, you know, they've been strengthened over the last several months. I don't have a lot of hope that, and I think most, you know, serious observers don't have a lot of hope that the Switzerland peace conference next month is going to lead to anything positive for the future of Syria.
And you say they've been strengthened by their willingness to give up their chemical weapons. Many people were critical of the Obama administration for putting that line in the sand over chemical weapons when so many people were suffering for all sorts of other reasons, 2 million Syrian refugees fleeing the country, for example, and all of the people who have died from all sorts of other things, missiles and the like, and general fighting. What message does all of this send about international concerns over chemical weapons above all other conflict?
Well, it sends a very negative message. I mean, the Syrian people, broadly speaking, are very disappointed, disillusioned, very angry at the international community, particularly at the United States, for making the conflict in Syria all about chemical weapons, which at most maybe have been responsible for 1% of the atrocities, while ignoring the 99% of atrocities that have resulted from the use of from conventional weapons. And so I think, you know, Obama drew a line in the sand, and he, you know, said about a year and a half ago that, you know, if chemical weapons are used or deployed, that would be a game changer. And when they were sort of, you know, used and deployed in August of this year, he had a problem. He had a problem of saving face, and that's really what I think the debate in late August and September was all about. It was about Obama trying to save face rather than trying to save Syrian lives. And once that issue was resolved as a result of, you know, very careful sort of diplomacy on behalf of Russia, who sort of intervened and gave Obama a way out, gave the Syrian regime a way out of a potential military strike, you know, the concern of the United States in Syria sort of diminished significantly, because chemical weapons were dealt with, they were being removed from the conflict, and that was perfectly fine from the perspective of the Obama administration. But the tragedy, of course, is that, you know, after that agreement was signed, the actual level of killing, humanitarian suffering, human rights abuses increased after that agreement was signed, and we're seeing that play out before our eyes today.
And the UN has appealed for $6.5 billion in aid for Syrian refugees and their host countries. Based on past experiences, I'm assuming not all of that money is going to come through.
I think that's a safe assumption. You know, the UN also is predicting that by next year, the number of refugees flowing out of Syria will double. The accepted figure right now is about 2.1, 2.3 million official registered refugees. I think the more accurate figure is about 3 million that have left, because not everyone has registered. And, you know, the international community is going to be struggling with this question of Syria, just dealing with the humanitarian suffering. The food aid that's required is going to, you know, deplete the resources of the international community. And this all, of course, you know, boils back to the root causes of the conflict. You know, we can deal with the symptoms and the humanitarian suffering, but of course the refugees don't want to remain refugees. They want to go back home, and they can't go back home until there's some stability, some resolution of this conflict. And I can't see that happening as long as the Assad regime is in power, and I can't see the conflict being resolved unless there's leadership from the international community, primarily from the United States. And that doesn't seem like it's going to happen. So the prognosis is not very good for the future of Syria or the future of the Middle East.
Nada Hashemi is director of the Center for Middle East Studies and an associate professor of Middle East and Islamic Politics at the University of Denver's Joseph Korbel School of International Studies. He has co-edited with Danny Postel, also of the University of Denver, a book, a collection of essays by thinkers who have taken very different positions on what we should do with in Syria. The book is called The Syria Dilemma. It is published by MIT Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for the opportunity.